hello, six pack of confidence. Been so many nights since we first met. Glad to see you brought all your friends for another night of Plastic Cup Politics.
Welcome to, and thanks for hitting play on a new episode of Plastic Cup Politics Podcast. I'm your host, Mark LaRue. He is Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD. That PhD is in political science. That's all you really need to know about him. Yeah. I don't care about all that internet shit and securities. No, we're just moving past that. You got a PhD. That's why we do this show, because I don't, and I get lots of questions that go through my head. And so I ask those questions to Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD, and he usually lets me know what that's all about. That's what we do at Plastic Cup Pod. If you have questions for Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD, we are an Arizona-based drinking and politics podcast. However you're listening to us, go ahead and hit subscribe. You're going to do it at the end anyway. Might as well just do it now while, you know, you're sitting in traffic. Wait, don't mess with your phone in traffic. While you're sitting in your driveway waiting for all your podcasts to download, which is how I spend the first 2 minutes when I'm like, man, I probably should have done this when I was in the shower. Anyway, you'll be set up. You'll be good to go. This is part of the show where I say, Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD, how's it going? What are you having?
Weren't you one of, like, the very first iPod-related car accidents?
I don't know if I was one of the very first, but I was definitely looking down at my iPod and crashed right into the back of somebody. Yes.
You were a very early adopter for iPod or iDevice related accidents. I remember that distinctly.
Good at distracted driving.
So I'm doing well. Generally a busy week, and I'm drinking, tragically, this is not from Arizona, it's from Colorado, by Oscar Blues Brewery.
Love Oscar Blues.
It's the Can O' Bliss IPA. It's pretty bitter, but it's an IPA. It's supposed to be bitter. It's also very sweet. It has a lot of fruit to it. I think it's got kind of a grapefruit flavor, but I don't. It's more than just grapefruit, I guess.
What's the name of it?
Can O' Bliss IPA.
I get it, man.
Yeah.
I do love myself some Oscar Blues. I've probably talked about it on the show before. Tin Fitty, their Imperial Stout, got me through the first couple months of living in Chicago. That was my shift beer. Keep me nice and warm on the way home. But yeah, always like Oscar Blues. Is that a can that you have?
Yes.
If you look, there will be a screen printed on it. You'll see something like a circle. It usually is.
Circle?
Yeah, like a circle with like a mesh over
it. I see it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a screen. Oh. So they show you where to puncture the can. So
you can smoke weed off of it. That's cute. That's adorable. God bless you, Colorado.
That was my favorite thing about any brewery that would come in and do promos when I worked in Chicago at headquarters was you can tell me whatever hops are in a beer, but I want the story. I need something to wrap around. And that was one of my selling points on all the Oscar Blues that I sold. If the person looked like that might be a sales pitch, I'd be like, check it out, dude. There's a screen on every can.
That's hilarious. I like
stories
it.
Sell beer. I am just drinking some water right now. Packing some stuff, packing records sucks, but onward and upward. So we will go sideways and over the mountain to where that brewery exists, and that is Cottonwood, Arizona. Cottonwood made some local news here recently where they had a city council meeting to decide whether they should regulate masks in the township of Cottonwood. I like township. Township sounds really cool. So there was a vote, and it came down 4-3 that they would not require masks, at which point the mayor, Tim Alinsky, stood up and said, you know what, guys? Sucks, but yes, everybody's going to have to wear masks. And here's the thing. Tim Alinsky is a really, really solid dude. I know this guy. This guy comes to the brewery. He has a kegerator that he gets our beer. And he serves, you know, local, can't get more local than that. His wife worked for Local First, and he stood up and did the right thing. And then there have been protests. People have been protesting outside of his house for doing the right thing. And the thing that gets me is that no matter what happens, he's going to be wrong. Because even if cases go down, people are just going to say, see, it wasn't that bad. We didn't even have to wear those stupid masks. He made us wear those stupid masks for nothing. I told you it wasn't that bad. It's a no-win situation. Dr. Shan Hayes, PhD, when we talked about this in our little chat, you really brought me down. But I guess you can keep me level.
Yeah, I definitely didn't mean to bring you down. I was sincere, though. I worry for the safety of public officials who are taking a stand right now about this sort of thing. There are some very, very unpleasant and unstable and violent individuals out there. And so, you know, I hope Tim the authorities in Cottonwood are exercising sort of a surfeit of caution right now. You sort of recapped almost exactly the conversation that we had on the night that vote took place. But since then, right, Tim has been entirely vindicated.
Right.
The numbers haven't flattened. They are skyrocketing and continuing to. We are on track to surpass 100,000 cases a day. That's crazy out of control. There's no way to pretend that we have the disease under control when we are headed back up and we are headed higher than we ever were. Right? It seemed like damn near the entire island of Manhattan was being simultaneously infected, and we still were not seeing case rates like we're seeing now. That's nuts. 100,000 new cases a day is the direction we're going. That's catastrophic. You know, that is that moment that everyone feared would come, where the healthcare system is completely overwhelmed because we have more people being hospitalized and requiring ventilators than we have available space, doctors, nurses, or vents. That's where 100,000 new cases a day puts us, right? And this time, it's not far, far away in a blue state. It's right here in good old red America. And still, there are people who not only are refusing to wear masks, right? I see those out when I'm, like, I had to go to the grocery store today, and I saw, you know, two different people who weren't wearing masks at all, a ton of other ones who had it below their nose, and then a few who had it down below their chin, and then one lady who clearly wears it normally but had pulled it below her chin to take a phone call. Really? And she had an iPhone. We're not talking about like some shitty phone. The caller clearly would have heard her on the other end of that call. She did not have to pull her mask down. But there are still some people out there who are sort of violently opposing mask wearing, even under the current circumstances. And it gives hope that there are still strong people out there willing to take a stand, even in the face of this kind of madness. And there's no other way to describe it. That's what it is. It's a madness, right? The European Union just left us off the list of approved countries to travel to Europe now that they're reopening international travel. And they left us off the list because we don't have COVID-19 under control. And they are terrified of allowing Americans to come to Europe right now, which Americans would. We've seen it, right? There is no way we can expect them to be responsible about it. If the EU opened their borders, Americans would be flooding fucking Europe right now for summer vacations.
Look at the deals, honey. The deals!
Exactly. And fucking Europe would then drown in new COVID-19 cases. And there are countries around the world that are just baffled. Right, they're looking at what's happening in supposedly the most powerful country on earth. Not supposedly, in reality, the most powerful country on earth. Right, like China is rapidly, is nipping at our heels, but they're still a distant third. Really, you'd have to say China at this point is a distant second, right? Because they've surpassed Russia by a long shot economically, and they are a nuclear power in their own right. So a distant second, but still distant, right? Our economy is still the economic engine of the world, right? It's us, Europe, and China. Us, the EU, and China in particular. And we still have we still have the world's only blue water navy, and we've got two of them. we're still the entertainment hub, and for the most part, the technology hub, even though a lot of it is it ends up actually being produced or administered in Asia, most of it comes out of Silicon Valley or the I-85 corridor on the East Coast. So the rest of the world is looking at us going, wow, how does this happen? You have all the money, you have all the technology, you have all the power, and yet you cannot manage to contain this disease.
Meanwhile, they're having rugby matches in New Zealand. Have you seen that?
No.
New Zealand had a full stadium, 40,000 people, all for a rugby match because they were celebrating 3 weeks with zero cases of COVID.
Nice.
And that's what you would be able to do if everybody wear their fucking mask.
Now, keep in mind, New Zealand's an island.
Very small.
And yeah. Right. So, like, 3 weeks without a single case? Sure, get everyone together in a stadium. Here, maybe we go a little longer than 3 weeks before we start filling stadiums with people. But we didn't even, we didn't even wait for zero case. We didn't even wait for falling trend lines before the president of the United States tried to fill a fucking stadium with 20,000 people.
Tried.
Only 6,000 showed up, but he tried.
Yeah.
It's shocking. And it's not just shocking to us. And it's not like the sort of the typical American bashing that goes on, in lots of countries around the world. And it's legit. I've lived abroad. I've traveled extensively abroad, and you do find anti-American sentiments in plenty of countries, including in Europe, in allied countries in Europe. You should see some of the shit I found spray painted on the walls in Florence, Italy, about Americans. You know, so like there's some of that sentiment there, but generally speaking, you know, we're talking about countries that have positive relationships with us, and they're terrified. They don't understand. The world has been flipped on its head. The country that's supposed to lead can't manage to get its shit together, and no one knows what to do now.
Shut down bars and water parks.
Yeah, shut down bars and water parks, but get ready to start in classroom K-12 school in a month.
Oh, no, they pushed that back by a couple of weeks. It's August something.
Yeah.
August 9th, I think.
Governor Ducey pushed it back by a week or 10 days or some shit like that. But they are still planning in-classroom school for slightly more than a month away, right? And, you know, I try to read very widely on these subjects. Now, I don't read bullshit, right? You're not going to catch me over at Breitbart or any of that stuff, but... You know, I'll read the journal to get a conservative take on things. I found, an online political magazine who I think in this case will remain nameless because I actually used to have a relationship with them and I still know some of the people who are writers there. But they published an embarrassingly, it's basically a well-intentioned doctor trying to make the case for a return to in-classroom school in the fall. And he was dressing it up as a scientifically driven argument. The problem is that the scientific certainties surrounding COVID-19 change from week to week. We don't have a handle on this disease. We don't know how it operates. We don't know for certain that kids can't be asymptomatic carriers. We don't know for certain that they can't bring the, you know, without even actually developing a pathology, whether they can spread the disease. We have no idea what the full extent of the impact of the disease is on kids, right? There's this bizarre syndrome that they've been finding in kids who do become symptomatic with COVID-19, a small percentage of them, that's very, very similar to Kawasaki's disease, which is like an inflammatory disease. It damages the tissues of the heart and the peripheral pulmonary system, not pulmonary, cardiovascular system. To come out a month before school is intended to resume, right, and make this argument as if you were certain enough to know what the consequences of a return to in-classroom school might be, especially when new infection rates are still trending up, dramatically upwards. Not a little up, way the fuck up, right? The guy, I sent you that the graphic that the Daily Show tweeted out like a week ago, right? And it was like Trevor Noah, you know, sort of tongue-in-cheek, we did it, America, we flattened the curve, right? And what it was a representation of our brief downward curve and then the upwards trend line, and they had become equal, and they just drew a line between the two and wrote flat above it, right? We flattened the curve. But you can't even run that graphic anymore because we are so far above the infection rates we were at previously. So the idea that they're, you know, I understand these are people of goodwill and they're making, you know, the guy was making an argument about some of the other difficulties that kids faced over the last few months when they had to stay home. And some of those difficulties are very real. But they are inconsequential in comparison to the impending damage we are all looking at from this disease if we continue with infection trends the way that they are, with the trend line for new infections. So we absolutely shouldn't be talking about sending every kid in America back to a classroom, right? We shouldn't be talking about corporations sending people back to offices right now. Mine certainly isn't, thank goodness, but I'm sure there are some companies out there that are considering it.
Yes.
Right? Given how eager folks in the entertainment and service industries were to immediately start right back up. I'm not one of those people who's like, I don't like to say I told you. No, fuck you. I told you so, and I enjoy saying it. I wish I didn't have to. I and plenty of other people said all along, we're doing this too soon. It's going to fuck us. The scariest take on it for the last sort of almost 2 weeks has been with Fauci's testimony before Congress, where they were talking about, you know, they're talking about this as a second wave, and he corrected them and said, no, we haven't left the first wave. This isn't a second wave. This is the next uptick in the first wave of infections here in the United States. That should give everyone pause. We haven't made it out of the first wave, and we're fucking it up.
Yeah, I was supposed to be killed by the heat, but man, it's been lovely out.
Well, not only that, but turns out we didn't know that was the case, right? People were claiming that it might be because we've seen other diseases, other pathogens that have been adversely impacted by hot, dry weather. Turns out this one is like, nice and balmy. I fucking love it. We should qualify that a tiny bit. Right. So it's actually not that they misunderstood the disease. It's that they misunderstood people. Right. So the disease, the actual pathogen, is adversely impacted by light, sunlight, UV radiation, and heat. Right. But what they didn't stop to think of is, what do people do when it's fucking hot outside? They all get together in air conditioned spaces. Small spaces with recycled air filled with multiple people, because outside of areas like the Southwest where we live, a lot of people don't have air conditioning at home. So when it gets really hot, they go to community spaces that have air conditioning. What a great fucking way to spread the virus.
Come on. We all went to the mall during the summertime because it had air conditioning. Or go to movies in the summertime because it had air conditioning. Really, really good air conditioning.
Yeah.
So, what do you think that Tammy Duckworth would think about that? Because I was reading on the Facebook page for Plastic Cup Politics podcast something about Tammy Duckworth.
Tammy Duckworth is a goddamn hero. So, you know, actually, she's come out very forcefully in favor of, like, mandatory masks and, you know, a coordinated national strategy to fight the disease. Oh my God, what a novel fucking idea. If only there was a set of institutions out there that had been designed by the founders of this country several centuries ago to do exactly that, provide a coordinated response in the event of a catastrophe that impacts all of us. Oh, holy shit, we actually do have one of those. Just the leader of it decided he wanted to take the pandemic off. Right? So everyone's been, you know, it's typical for you know, election year politics, the you know, in years where we have, where it's an open presidency and we have, you know, we have both Republicans and Democrats running, you get a double veep stakes, right? But in off-year elections like this one, they just talk about the challenger's VP pick. So everyone has been talking about who Biden is going to slash should pick for VP. And I should say, I am neither not the only nor even the first person to make a public case for Tammy Duckworth. There was a good op-ed in the New York Times a couple days ago about it. So for those of you who don't know, Tammy Duckworth is she was a two-term representative in the House of Representatives, and now she is in her first term as a United States Senator. I don't want to fuck it up. She is the junior U.S. Senator from Illinois.
Well, I mean, the junior senator from Illinois has worked before.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Oh, yeah. People are going to scream conspiracies. There's all sorts of amazing stuff about Tammy Duckworth, right? So, one, like, it's just sort of the litmus test for the VP pick this year, announced by the candidate himself, was that first and foremost, you had to be a woman. It even makes me a tiny bit uncomfortable to hear it put out there that way. But in the end, it's the right thing to do. I think that there are certain circumstances under which we have to sort of force change to happen. And this is one of those circumstances where the candidate, you know, quite reasonably, I think, in this case goes, nope. You know, I know I really want to just sort of generally be open to picking the best candidate, but I have an opportunity to really force a significant moment of change in the United States, and I need to take it. And so that's what he's doing. There has also been significant pressure to ensure that it is a person of color. And Tammy Duckworth also qualifies there. She has a very white name. But Tammy herself is, so she's the daughter of a U.S. Army veteran, Frank Duckworth, and a Thai woman by the name of Lamai Samporn Parin. I'm fucking it up. I'm sorry.
But Plastic Cup Pod, if you know the correct pronunciation.
She then, you know, she was born in Thailand, but obviously moved here. Her family moved here. She was raised in the United States, and she joined the United States Army, where she became a helicopter pilot, which, for those of you who aren't aware, isn't a job they give to just anyone. And in 2004, while piloting her Black Hawk helicopter near Baghdad, the helicopter was struck by a rocket-propelled grenade, and it almost killed her and cost her both of her legs. She was also very badly burned because, you know, very often accidents in helicopters result in fuel being sprayed all over the place. She and her crew managed to pilot the helicopter back to the ground. Her crew then pulled her from the burning wreckage. She recovered, thankfully, and came home, and then went on to do a bunch of other really interesting stuff before running for Congress successfully, and now is a senator. She ticks all the boxes, Mark, in terms of not only satisfying sort of this urge from the left to ensure that one of the two candidates on the ticket is a woman and a person of color, she also sort of, you know, it becomes very, very difficult to attack the Democratic ticket on issues of around the military when the VP is Tammy Duckworth. And the president had a son who served in the Marines. So, you know.
Also, she has one talking point instantly in that she was born on foreign soil to one American parent, which I do believe Donald Trump tried to put an end to, or did put an end to. So there's a little speech right there just waiting to happen.
Yeah, and then so she gets to Congress, and because she wants to continue to be a badass, or that's just who she is, she now has two kids that she has had since being elected to Congress, and she was the first woman ever to bring her child with her onto the floor of the Senate. There just aren't any barriers for her. And it's really, really cool. It's been really cool to watch since she first ran. And at the time that we first encountered her, it was shortly after sort of the sad tale of the way the Republican Party mistreated Max Cleland, who was a Vietnam vet, who was either a double or even quadruple amputee. I can't remember at this point. But he was pretty shamefully mistreated by the Republican Party. And then Tammy sort of came on the scene shortly thereafter. So in my mind, for whatever reason, they're always sort of connected, even though I don't know that they ever actually did anything together.
Excellent. How's that Bolton book?
Oh, holy fuck, man. All right, so I'm a quarter of the way through. I know I said I would read it all before we record it again. But God damn it. Like, he doesn't make it easy, Mark. Not only is he a terrible person, writing about his relationships with other terrible people, he's a terrible writer. There's no narrative structure to the book. It's literally just a retelling of the story from the moment the Trump administration started courting him for the job. Although, even when you're reading his account, it really actually sounds a lot like he was, in fact, coming after them for the job and not the other way around. And he went through sort of multiple interview periods over the course of the first year of the Trump presidency, where they kept trying to offer him other less important jobs than national security advisor. It took a while for them to eventually get around to to wanting John Bolton in the room. And after reading a quarter of his book, I understand why. Even though it is perfectly reasonable for people to have the reaction like, dude, fuck you. You should have testified about this in front of Congress. Right? And for the people, by the way, who think that like he did it literally so he could make more money, I'm fairly certain he actually already had the $2 million deal signed at that point. He wasn't going to get any more or less money if he testified in front of Congress. I don't think that's why he did it. I think he did it that way because he's an asshole. If there's anything you come away from reading his book absolutely 100% certain of, it's that John Bolton is a grade A asshole. Not a nice person. Not a pleasant person to be around. Never has a positive word to say about another human being unless they have something that they can do for him. The consummate name dropper, like the worst kind of name dropper, the kind of person who will work a past association with a prominent political figure into a conversation in the most tortured way, just so that they can let you know that once upon a time they talked to that person. The almost consistent lack of consistency. Like, that's the other thing you can count on from him and this retelling, is that it will change from, or his perspective will change from minute to minute, which means that he is in some ways ideally suited to a relationship with Donald Trump, right? Because the two of them can just constantly flip the script on one another and feel like these genius Svengalis. Maybe we can just stick them both in like side-by-side padded cells and let them both plot to take over the world every night while they bang their head off of a rubber wall. Having said all of that, because I absolutely had to say all of that, not only because I feel my credibility would suffer if I didn't say all of that, it would suffer amongst any of our listeners who actually bother to read this pile of shit.
Shout out to my mom.
Is she reading it?
She got the Audible version.
All right.
She says he's very pompous.
Who he read it himself?
Oh, I don't know who read it, but I don't know who did the Audible version.
Because I was going to be seriously jealous if he read it himself. I would have to go get the Audible version if he read it himself. Because hearing this book in his own words has to be an experience.
I said it was a drug deal.
Yeah. So look, he is 100% convinced that he's the smartest man in the room at any moment. Right? Now, that's only because, like, Kissinger's not in the room. But I'm pretty sure he even thinks he's smarter than Kissinger. I'm not saying Kissinger is smart, but this is one of the people that Bolton holds up as being one of the smartest people he's ever interacted with. Right? And he makes sure to tell you that he has personally interacted with Kissinger on many occasions. You know, he name drops Jim Baker, who not of Jim and Tammy Faye. James Baker, former National Security Advisor and then Secretary of State.
Yes.
James Baker. So he has two persistent habits throughout the text. There are other habits that come and go, but these two will always come back. He never says that someone lies, right? He'll write out a statement, and then at the end, in brackets, it'll say the opposite of the truth, which, of course, is an absolutely idiotic way to say this is a lie, right? The other thing he does is he constantly references this conversation he had with Baker years ago, where the conversation at the end, they're both talking about, like, how they think things should go, and they disagree with the choice the president is making. And Baker ends the conversation with, "I'm not the guy who got elected." The takeaway from which is supposed to be, as National Security Advisor, you don't have your own agenda. The agenda is the agenda of the guy who got elected, right? He mentions this story over and fucking over again, Mark. He tells it in full once and then references it repeatedly throughout the text, and then proceeds to tell an ongoing tale of how he did everything he could to ensure that the guy who got elected didn't get what he wanted. You can't have both, John. You are either James Baker, the guy who goes, "I'm not the one who got elected, so this is what we're going to do," or you're the guy who is the smartest man in the room and is going to manage to manipulate Donald Trump into doing what you think is best as opposed to what the guy who got elected thinks is best. Now, whether or not Bolton is right about whether they should do what he wants or what Trump wants, the fact is that, I mean, that's a turd burger versus shit sandwich scenario, if ever there was one, right? If your only options are the instincts of Donald Trump versus the instincts of John Bolton, you are 100% F-U-C-K-E-D fucked, right? If those are your only two options, which, by the way, is how we ended up abandoning a couple of major nuclear arms treaties with Russia. It's how we ended up walking away from the arms control agreement with Iran. The only thing that their time together produced that wasn't ultimately what Bolton wanted anyway was the, you know, and in the end, by the way, North Korea still fell apart anyway, but not because, you know, not because it went not Bolton's way, but because, you know, the whole thing was a joke to begin with anyway, right? It was never really going to happen. A large part of the narrative from the first half of the book, and narrative I'm putting irony quotes around, revolves around, like, his horror at the idea of dealing directly with Kim Jong-un, of paying him that respect, of letting him meet directly with the president, and blah, 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 blah. That's the other thing. For a guy who claims to be the smartest man in the room at any given moment, and just a master of strategy and international relations, they get the drop on him so many fucking times, Mark. And the people who very often manage to sort of maneuver him into a corner are the same people he consistently tells us are complete idiots. Well, if they're complete idiots, what does that make you, John? They kicked your ass every time you had an interaction with them. Like, intellectually, strategically, they kicked your ass every single fucking time. I'm going to keep reading it. I will come back with more insights than that. The one thing that you should take away in terms of the Trump White House is if there's one through line to the story that Bolton has told thus far that rings absolutely true, it's that there is no strategy. The Trump White House is pure chaos from top to bottom. And it's because that's the way the guy at the top either wants it to be or needs it to be or can't make it otherwise.
The A1 focus is getting reelected.
And even that, there are now multiple competing camps surrounding the reelection effort. Right? Just today, it was announced that Jared Kushner, not previously associated with the election, with the campaign, the 2020 campaign, switched out the chief operating officer of the Trump for re-election Grand Poobah campaign 2020. The campaign has a manager. His name is Brad Parscale. Granted, I think he's a dumbass, but he's still smarter than Jared Kushner. But apparently Jared wants to get involved. So even around the election, there's not even a singular focus there, Mark. There's no strategy. No one associated with the entire organization who knows how to string together a consistent long-term strategy.
Jared Kushner's got to be pretty smart. He's also in charge of a Middle East peace. So, I mean, whatever it takes.
That's working out.
Yeah, not great so far. Speaking of not great, it's come out recently that allegedly Vladimir Putin and Russia were putting bounties on the heads of American soldiers through the Taliban. It's gone back and forth. There are some of our intelligence agencies that are doubting the intel, but apparently it did make it to Trump's desk in his daily morning briefings, which I've heard are have to be cartoons or he won't pay attention to them. But what's the deal with this whole thing?
So I hadn't heard of any dissenting agencies, and to be quite honest, I would be skeptical. The important part specifically about whether there is dissent among the agencies. So that is actually a little bit of agitprop that's being put out by the administration to try and support the case that the president wasn't shown, or it wasn't highlighted. This piece of intelligence wasn't highlighted in what's called the PDB, the Presidential's Daily Briefing, because the intelligence was unverified and they hadn't reached a definitive conclusion about it yet. Which technically is true, but the evidence in favor is very, very strong, Mark. There is far more certainty here than uncertainty. The questions I think that remain to be answered really are in the details, as opposed to whether or not this was actually happening, because they've managed to trace wire transfers from Russian sources to Taliban sources, right? So they have other intelligence to corroborate that, but they have a clear audit trail at this point of a cash transfer taking place. I haven't heard it mentioned yet because I think that a lot of people might feel that it is in poor taste to bring it up. But look, I think it's important to understand the historical context behind what's happening here. Once upon a time, it was Russia who had invaded Afghanistan and was an occupying force there. And once upon a time, a U.S. intelligence agency set up a program to finance a group of resistance fighters called the Mujahideen, right, which were both Afghanis and then Arabs from around the Muslim world. Don't let me fuck that up. Not just Arabs, but people from around the Muslim world who came to Afghanistan and trained with the Mujahideen, right? And then usually this training actually took place in Pakistan. And then they went across the border and they were paid to kill the Russians. If this is substantiated, that a Russian intelligence agency has been paying the Taliban to kill Americans, that's not a coincidence that they did it that way.
Payback for 81?
Yeah, that's evidence that they have a very long memory. There was also another recent, a more recent event in Syria where a group of Syrian irregulars, right? It wasn't the actual Syrian army. It was militias, pro-Assad militias, and some terrorist fighters. And then a bunch of Russian mercenaries who were approaching a U.S. base in Syria, and the U.S. mounted an overwhelming response that ended up killing hundreds of these irregulars, including like a couple hundred Russian mercenaries. So there is some reason to believe that this was a direct retaliation for that event, but it was staged the way that it was to send a very clear message.
Gross.
Yeah, it's gnarly. You know, there's now it is more likely than not at this point that the program was actually successful, and that some American service members lost their lives as a part of this bounty program. And the really gross part about it is that nothing is going to happen in response. Because our government, well, no, not our government, specifically our president, is beholden to the Russian government.
Yes, it does seem like Russia has something, which I was kind of laughing to myself about, because I was fighting on the Paul Gosser page with somebody who was talking about how they thought that Justice Roberts had been turned, and Justice Roberts, he's one of the swamp people, and they must have something on him, because sometimes he votes the other way. And I'm just thinking to myself, oh, shit, that's kind of what I was thinking. Like, oh, president, they must have something on the president. Conspiracy theories. Woo!
These people are such goddamn fools, man. Look, Chief Justice Roberts is not a liberal. He is a staunch conservative, but he is also sort of he is a jealous guardian of the court's power, right? And I use that language very specifically. So for any of our listeners who are familiar with the Federalist Papers, for those of you who aren't familiar, back around the time when they were trying to convince the people of the at that point U.S. Confederacy, the Confederation of U.S. States, to ratify the new Constitution, there was a series of letters published. And they were published as opinion pieces. They were published under a pseudonym. They went by Publius, which is a Latin name. And it was actually three writers. It was Alexander Hamilton. why can't I remember Madison's first name? James Madison. James? And John Jay. And then they were actually writing sort of they were in dialogue with a guy who wrote under the pseudonym of Brutus. And his collections are published under usually they're published with the Federalist Papers now, and they're like the Musings of a Federal Farmer or some shit like that is what they call them. I can't remember. In the Federalist Papers, very often, and in particular, you'll hear Madison use this language of sort of the various branches of government jealously guarding their power. Right? That was the idea, all three branches. And this is going to sound kind of weird to some of our younger listeners right now, because they've grown up in an era where the executive has become way too powerful, in part because Congress has voluntarily surrendered a bunch of its power to the executive. All three branches were intended to be A, co-equal, right, and B, jealous guardians of their power, so that they would stand in staunch opposition to any of the other branches eventually usurping any of their areas of control. And it was supposed to be that jealous opposition that would make them good guardians of liberty. Right? They would watch over the other two branches to make sure that they weren't getting more than their fair share and weren't becoming too powerful. Because if any one branch became too powerful, it was a threat to the liberty of the people of the United States. That has not changed. It is still a threat to the liberty of the people of the United States, which has been a consistent theme of our conversations on this show. So, Roberts, and this is literally the only thing I will credit to the man, other than the fact that he is genuinely a very smart individual, is that he is sort of the consummate jealous guardian of the court's prerogatives. And so the few times that he has voted to frustrate the Trump administration and their troglodytic supporters in the last 2 weeks haven't actually been votes in support of the liberal position. They have been votes in support of the administration and its adherents following proper process with regard to the court itself. In the most recent one, the abortion one, this was a rebuke to the lower courts, to state and lower federal courts, basically saying, look, you will respect Supreme Court precedent. If you are going to send these cases back up to us, you damn well better be sure that you provide a convincing reason why this court should overturn a past precedent. Which, of course, from Roberts was an invitation, because he wants to overturn this precedent, right? He wants to make it easier for states to restrict access to abortion until it becomes functionally illegal again in most of the United States. He is a true believer. But he absolutely will not allow, especially a lower federal court, to flaunt the authority of the Supreme Court. And the same holds with the Trump administration, the times that he's voted against them. It has, and in fact, he explicitly said the last time that he voted against them, because look, get your shit together. There is a way for you to go about petitioning this court for relief. You have ignored those procedures. Thus, I am voting against you. So, A, there are some folks on the left who are praying that he's a crypto-liberal. He is not. And there are some folks on the right who are buying into these conspiracy theories that somehow he's bought and paid for, or he's a closet liberal, or he's been corrupted by the Russians, apparently. No, he's not that either. He is performing the job as the framers of the Constitution intended him to perform it. And good for him. More power to him. Well done.
All right. And as we pull this thing into a close, what's up with the Emancipation Statue? I don't even know anything about that.
All right. So there's a statue in D.C. of Lincoln, and he has the Emancipation Proclamation in one hand, and the other hand is outstretched downward because there is a loincloth-clad slave kneeling. Now, the statue seems very clear in its intent that he is offering his hand, after having read the Emancipation Proclamation, to this kneeling slave to lift him up. It is, unfortunately, possible to misinterpret that statue, right, as perpetuating stereotypes of sort of the subjugated black man or the black man in need of rescue by a white savior. I think I think those arguments are unconvincing on their face. I think the intent of the statue is fairly clear. It was created in celebration of the Emancipation Proclamation, I think it tends to communicate that message in a very powerful and sort of serious and somber way. But the reason I wanted to mention it is because it is, and we've discussed this on this show before. By the way, this is their red IPA that I'm opening now. Still from Oscar Blues, but this is called Gnight. GNIGHT.
Oh, dude, you are in for a treat.
Nice.
That shit is so good. That's how I learned that I like IPAs. This is a red imperial IPA, 8.7%, so you'll sleep well. but, like, to me, I'm like, oh, this is an IPA? I can totally drink IPAs then.
Yeah, well, I remember you telling me before that the reds are like a good intro to IPAs because they're not as hoppy, and this is definitely not as bitter.
Yeah, see, dude, it's a double red IPA. So nice. Good. Yeah.
I like it.
Oh, man, I wish I was drinking that right now. Anyway, back to the Emancipation Statue.
I wanted to make two points. One, and we've talked about this on this show before, it's possible for the pendulum to swing too far in either direction, right? And in this case, our reaction as Americans, not even just as the Black Lives Matter movement, may have swung a little too far in the other direction when we're talking about a need to tear down this particular statue because it portrays an African-American, a black slave, right? It's unfair to say that it's an African-American slave because the slave in that statue might very well have been born here in the United States, in which case they weren't African American, they were American, right? They're from here, which I think is an important message, by the way, that's been coming up repeatedly over the last few years. And I think it's a really, really great and powerful message for people to continue to focus on, right? This whole idea that there is one group of individuals that is from here and everyone else can go back where they came from if they don't like it, A, is factually incorrect because white people aren't from here either. But B, in most cases, is also factually incorrect because most of the time the people you're talking to are from here. They were born here. And even it gets like, there was a really cool song that was played on the Grammys last year. What's the guy's name? I think it's Gary Clark Jr.
Yeah.
That's his name.
This is
Where I Come From. Fucking amazing song. And the idea wasn't just I come from America, but I come from the South. Don't tell me to go back where I came from. I come from here, and I will stand and defend this. This is mine. This is where I come from. So an important message. So I think it's important to honor that even with, you know, things like this statue. We don't know if he was an African American. He might have just been an American.
We could tell Sean means it by the tapping.
Mm. Sorry. I didn't even realize I was doing it. Okay. So the statue, it's possible that we went too far, that we are in danger of going too far in the other direction. Now, I want to say that just like most of America, though, even I, and I'm already pretty far to the goddamn left on most of these issues, have made some movement in the last couple of weeks when initially people started going after statues of Washington and Jefferson, right? And even Teddy Roosevelt in New York at the Natural History Museum. My first instinct was to go, no, right? The optics of this are so bad. You need the support of Middle America moving forward, and you will lose it if you go out. I mean, literally, there are paintings in the rotunda in D.C. at the Capitol of Washington being depicted during apotheosis, which literally means ascension into godhood, right? Like, we've taken these individuals who founded the country, and through a weird sleight of hand, we made them and a pair of documents, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution / Bill of Rights, stand in for a king. Right? That's been the attention all along. As opposed to venerating an individual, we are supposed to venerate what this group of individuals did and the documents they produced. That's why we're trained from early childhood to sort of revere the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. That's not an accident. And so you very well might risk losing a lot of moderate Americans by going after such powerful symbols. And then I gave it a little thought. And it seems like a lot of America gave it a little thought too, because there wasn't the powerful counter reaction that I thought there would be. And I think in part that's because, like, sort of the Washington and Jefferson episodes were sort of a flash in the pan, right? They weren't persistent. But I think it's also in part because a lot of other people went, wait, this one's a little trickier than the Lincoln statue, right? Because the intent behind the Lincoln statue is fairly clear. There's no other way to say it other than the fact that Washington and Jefferson were slave owners. And they weren't reluctant slave owners. We've painted them as such in later years to try and soften their image. But these were people who had plantations, and they owned other human beings and forced those human beings to work on their plantations so that they could accumulate wealth. That's not something that they should be automatically forgiven for, even if they went on to do other amazing things, like founding this incredible country. And in part because they added insult to injury, right? Not only did they found this incredible country, but some of those same individuals went on to contribute to the language in the original Constitution, which declared that black people were only 3/5 human. So maybe it's a good idea for everyone, even those of us who think we are allies, to sort of check our first response to some of these developments. And it goes in the other direction, too. I was super enthusiastic about the autonomous zone up in Seattle. Turns out to be a really terrible fucking idea in practice. Maybe we do need to sort of rethink how we talk about Washington and Jefferson.
Can't we just do it the way that I boycott McDonald's, where it's you start with one thing. Hey, let's get rid of the Confederate statues. Can we all agree that they're fucking traitorous losers? Okay, sorry. Can we get like 75% of Americans to think that they're treasonous losers? I think we can do that. Then we can get all that stuff gone. And then we can go, how about we take a look at the old founding fathers? And then we can have a discussion and figure out whether we need that stuff gone. Because that's the way I'm trying to do it. I'm not eating McDonald's. And then as soon as McDonald's folds, guess what? I'm not going to Burger King anymore.
All right. Well, there's two things I would say to that. And I think we absolutely need to wrap it up because I don't want to make this any tougher to edit than it already is. The two things I would say are this. Look, one, I think we need to be careful about how we talk about this issue because no one is suggesting that either the traitorous losers from the Confederacy or the founding fathers go away.
No, as we were discussing in the last episode, we're saying don't celebrate them.
Don't celebrate them. Learn about them. Remember what they did. And appreciate the good they did, right? Because some of these same Confederate traitors, by the way, did contribute powerfully to the development of the United States before they turned their back on it. So I think in the historical record, it's important to recognize those things as well. It doesn't mean they were a good person, but they did a good thing. They still don't deserve a fucking statue because they were traitors who betrayed their country and murdered their countrymen to preserve a barbaric and immoral institution. An institution that they knew at the time was barbaric and immoral. People talk about, oh, well, it was a different time. No, it wasn't a different goddamn time. There were people who had just finished sacrificing their lives to bring the transatlantic slave trade to an end in the UK. There were abolitionists all over the place here in the United States. They were the ones who were driving the push to bring an end to slavery in the first place. It wasn't just an economic argument. It was a powerful moral and ethical and religious argument that was being made against slavery. So this is what I'm talking about, right? Instead of having statues that celebrate Washington as ascending into God, paintings that celebrate him as ascending into Godhood, statues that celebrate him as this unassailable figure, maybe we need to bring the statues down and we need to talk about the man in context, right? And that context is we have a man who did, on the one hand, an amazing thing that has worked out incredibly well for, in truth, all of us, right? Even the people who are getting fucked by the system are still much better off than their peers in countries that are not the United States. That requires all sorts of qualifications, but you understand what I mean. I'm not talking about industrialized countries. It's the same old canard, right? Like, if you don't love it here, why don't you get the hell out? Where am I going to go? Right? A lot of the countries on Earth are still, underdeveloped, and there are a lot of horrible problems there, and so life is worse there for a lot of the people than it is here. At the very same time, it's not good enough. There is still a long, long way to go for it not to be just better than it is in Somalia, but for us to actually be a just society. And so I think maybe that's what the historical record should reflect, is the dialogue around that arc of history, right? The long arc of history bends towards justice. I think it was King who said that. He may have been paraphrasing Gandhi, I can't remember. But it's become President Obama actually brought it back. He referred to it around the time of the beer summit, which we've referenced at this on this podcast a number of times. So the long narrative arc of history bends towards justice, right? So, and I think in the end that's actually true. But we have to talk about these people in that context. We're talking about individuals, Washington and Jefferson, the same, who owned other human beings, and they did so in the knowledge that there were many, many other people who considered them to be evil for doing so. And still they did it. They didn't have to. They could have chosen not to. Many, 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 many people chose not to. And so it's not fair to say they did this great thing and we should dismiss this evil they did because it was a different time. No, we have to have a more nuanced and accurate picture of these people to understand how we should parse what they did and what lessons we should learn from them.
If you want to see a giant love it or leave it sign, feel free to drive through Cornville, Arizona. Saw one today. It was pretty...
love it or leave it.
It existed with a giant Trump flag. I guess I should say that we are recording on the on July 1st. And I'm going to wrap this up. I'm going to go watch more AEW Fighter Fest.
Nice.
If you're into wrestling... AEW, that's the new shit. It's good. And interact with the show at Plastic Cup Pod. However you're listening, hit subscribe. I'll talk to you soon.
Nice. Whoa!